If you warm the planet up by several degrees centigrade, adding carbon dioxide, I think it's fair to say, and this may sound wacky and extreme, but there's no scientific doubt that you could cool it back down to whatever temperature you want. But you would not have the same climate when you were done. So it's inherent in the science of this, and this is imperfect or limited. So while you could cool down the global temperature the same place, you would have a different hydrological cycle, different amount of rainfall and evaporation, and in many other ways a slightly different climate. It might or might not be that doing this would reduce the risk of climate change. Certainly all the standard models that we use to understand the risk of putting CO2 in the air, the models that say we should take the risk of putting CO2 in the air very seriously, when you run those models and put reflective particles in the stratosphere, you find that at least with a limited amount of particles, you can reduce the obvious measures we have of climate change, temperature, precipitation, and all of these. You can reduce those essentially everywhere. And indeed, you can reduce them everywhere to a large extent in most models. Looking forward to questions, I guess I just want to say some of the really basic ways in which this is a sort of bizarre paradox. So the biggest concern about this certainly is that simply knowledge that it's possible will make people less eager to cut emissions. Mm-hmm. And indeed, there has been essentially a taboo about this. So the scientific community has known this is possible, and it was discussed in the major reports about climate change, like the one that went to President Johnson in 65 or the Energy and Climate Report in 77. But then in the sort of recent decade where climate change was more public concern, it wasn't discussed until Paul Crutzen, a Nobel Prize winner for ozone chemistry, sort of broke the taboo a half a decade or so ago. And since then, suddenly, the topic has exploded. So, you know, I've testified in Congress recently. There's a global governance initiative starting up. All sorts of things are happening very, very fast on this topic right now, for better or for worse. In many ways, I think it's happening too fast. I think at the root, there's a sort of paradox here. On the one hand, it seems like the ultimate kind of technological overreach. You know, lots of examples where people have tried to fix one environmental problem by imposing some other thing. You know, we have mongoose in Hawaii to control the rats, and those mongoose cause other problems. On the other hand, there are lots of technological fixes that actually in the crude ways work. I mean, it's a crude technological fix to scrub sulfur out of coal-fired power plants, but actually it's made the world a lot better than it would have been if we hadn't done that. So one way to look at it is sort of a gross technological overreach, and the other way to look at it is it may actually be one of the few ways we could, perhaps the only way, and I may sound like an overstatement, that we could provide a real limitation to the environmental risk of ecosystems or sense of, like the high Arctic, over the next, say, half century. Because the reality of the inertia of carbon and climate is that while in the long run we must cut emissions, and this technology does not get us out of the long run necessity of cut emissions, it is also simply a fact of the way the carbon cycle works that nothing you're going to do to cut emissions in the next 50 years will alter very much about the rate of climate change that's because of the long inertia of carbon and climate. And that's one of the central reasons it's been so hard to make progress. So I look forward to questions. Thank you.
Thanks. Eli, do you want to give us a journalist perspective?
Sure. Can everyone hear me in the room? I'm Eli Kintish. I cover policy issues for Science Magazine. And I think I'm going to use my 5 minutes to talk about what I think are the roles of journalists in covering this new emerging field. Because I've done it myself, and I'm starting to see more and more of my colleagues write about geoengineering or about the two types of geoengineering, one being radiation management, cooling the planet by blocking sunlight, or carbon management, just removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And I think both of them have challenges for journalists, and I'm seeing good journalism, and I'm seeing not so good journalism. I think the first responsibility of reporters writing about the topic is to really vigorously report both on new ideas as they're introduced by scientists, and also to challenge those ideas and look for their flaws. And I see a fair amount of kind of boosterish reporting. There's a kind of sexiness to geoengineering. You know, you might come up with solutions, and I think it's really up to journalists to put those proposals to the test and David has identified that in the nuclear weapons field, you have these red teams and blue teams. The blue teams generally come up with, you know, new weapons ideas, and the red teams sort of challenge them. And I think there ought to be scientists, and there are scientists who are starting to kind of coalesce around these roles. But I think also journalists ought to, you know, look to both sides and to play both roles. It would be foolish to ignore new ideas when they come out, but it's also the responsibility of journalists to put them through their paces. The second thing that I think reporters ought to do when it comes to climate engineering and carbon engineering is to really focus strongly on what the problems are that we are trying to solve. What are the climate impacts that we are facing, and how are proposed solutions either appropriate or inappropriate for responding to them? There's a lot of focus on the aerosols idea of putting fine particles in the stratosphere because we know from volcanoes that can cool the global temperature. Now scientists are starting to think about how those approaches might affect certain particular issues like the Arctic, the, you know, maybe the sea ice, what about drought? So I think it's important to separate these sexy and controversial ideas from the problems that are out there. And I think in general there's not enough reporting on sort of the worst case scenarios, which is a good part of what I've tried to write my book and focus on. The next thing I think that journalists ought to think about and do when they're writing about geoengineering is really investigate who is studying it, who is paying for the research in geoengineering, what foreign countries are doing, what the United States government is doing. I think there's a really important aspect here that is about openness. And I think for the most part, the scientists that I've interacted with, including David and the team here at Missoula, are open about the work they're doing and are really, I think, admirably tried to balance openness with the challenges which openness can raise. And I think it's important for journalists to really push to report on who is paying for research. And David and I have a kind of personal experience with this because I was among a handful of reporters who knew that David was funded by Bill Gates, and so that actually was an issue. He has some funding for all sorts of energy work, and a portion of that is focused on questions of geoengineering. And I think it's really important that who is funding research, who is doing research, are open questions, and there are a variety of reasons why that is. Another thing I think that it's important for journalists to focus on is kind of what situations would one use, not only what questions you would want to answer, but under what circumstances specifically one would want to deploy some of these radical schemes. For example, there's the question, okay, is geoengineering a kind of emergency procedure that one would utilize in an emergency? But then that raises the question, would we know an emergency is upon us? I mean, essentially, one of the pioneers in the climate community on this has been a guy named Tom Wigley, who had a paper in Science 5-6 years ago basically saying that we ought to be cutting emissions and doing this radiation management as soon as possible. And the reason is he feels we are in that worst-case scenario zone already. And so I think sort of rigorously challenging this idea of worst-case scenario and understanding it is a big role for journalists. Finally, just two more things. First, I think there's a kind of laziness on the part of reporters about what the debate on geoengineering is, because I don't think there's really right now many serious people at all who think we should be deploying climate cooling technologies or building giant machines to cool the planet. The debate right now is what sort of research to do, and I think that's important to be specific on. And finally, I think we need to be vigorous about not only the costs and effects of doing these various techniques, but what are the costs and effects of not doing them? There's an implicit trade-off there, and I think that's often left off. So with that, go on.
Dean, you're going to talk about some ethics.
Right. I'm part of a group here at the University of Montana. We're putting on a workshop Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday on ethics and geoengineering, and David's going to be taking part of that. So I think on Thursday I might be able to give you better answers than I can today. We were talking about this in my class the other day. I teach a class on climate change ethics and policy, and we were discussing this, and one of the students said, well, that's Botox for the planet, which of course would be unethical. But one of the things, you know, I think the question now, you know, no one's talking seriously about deployment, but should we arm ourselves in the future by doing research now in case we need it, right? And so when you do that, you know, it's kind of like, is it prudent to prepare for our own imprudence? Because obviously if we get to this point, we have acted imprudently. And I use prudence not in sort of a practical way, but a moral way. Imprudent behavior, like, you know, military expeditions that don't work out is not just stupid, it's morally wrong. And so I use it as an ethical term for decision making. So the other thing, if we do ultimately decide, you know, that it is prudent to prepare for our own imprudence, we also need to be thinking about some really tricky issues in deployment, ethical issues. I think what people are talking about, there's just sort of three categories with many subcategories involved, and that's risk management issues. What are we going to put at risk? What kind of ecosystems? You know, what are we willing to put at risk? And that's all, you know, that is a question of values. There will be perhaps regional difference. David was telling me maybe not as much as we think, but how will those regional differences be taken into account? And then there's double effects. Some of these technologies could potentially be used for military purposes, for example. And there's several double effects, unintended uses of these technologies. And there's a load of justice issues associated, but those justice issues are very similar to the same justice issues that we have in our climate change discussions right now about climate change policy. You know, there is no distributed justice, I've heard, without, you know, procedural justice. And so could we set up some procedural justice that would lead to distributed justice on the sharing of the risk, burdens, cost of any of these sorts of projects? And then there's a whole, you know, level of governance issues that we would have to have really robust governance if this was done. And, you know, as it's been said, and I think this is roughly a quote from someone, you know, who has the moral authority to take control of the Earth's thermostat? So that's kind of the three general areas that people are discussing in anticipation, sort of thinking these things out long before we do something like this. The other way it's been framed is sort of the lesser of two evils. You know, I'm sure many environmentalists are, you know, have sort of a knee-jerk or sort of an intrinsic moral repulsion to this sort of idea. But the idea is we may get to some point that it's either, you know, put these, bioregions, ecosystems, you know, and non-human animals at risk, that this may be the lesser of two evils. And so I think when you get to that point, you have to sort of go, well, what sort of criteria would you use? And there's an article by Dale Jamieson we could talk about. He uses sort of a just war theory way of reasoning. And, well, if it meets these criteria, then we would be able to do this. Another thing is we're not, you know, if we fail to act on climate change, we're putting future generations at risk. And so one thing we might do is sort of arm future generations. This is an article by Steve Gardner who talks about this. And he kind of dismisses it in the sense that, well, they're going to say, well, thank you for, you know, not doing something about climate change, but giving us this technology, and that's not actually going to get us off the hook. But one could also say that, you know, we should arm them against our own imprudence, because he also wrote another essay called, The Perfect Moral Storm, that explained why climate change is a really, really difficult moral problem for humans to handle. And so it could be that maybe this is really hard for us to do, and we should sort of hedge our bets, sort of a realism about it. Uh-huh. And the other thing is you could look at geoengineering or solar radiation management as a technological fix, and we have thought about it. It's just a common rhetorical term people use, but there has been research on technological fixes, and David pointed to, you know, like scrubbers and coal fire plants where they work. But they work for what, for who, you know, they are essentially conservative. And so we could talk about the moral application of technological fixes under the context that we use them all the time. And yet in our rhetoric, we dismiss technological fixes. So there's sort of this ambiguity in our actions and our rhetoric. So those are just some of the topics that we could talk about, you know, the risk management, justice issues, and governance issues that people are thinking in anticipation. And then sort of the lesser of two evils, arming the future, technological fix, ways of talking about the ethics of these things. Thanks. Oh, by the way, I have flyers for a talk David Keith is going to be on a panel on Monday night with two other leading scientists, Alan Robach and Phil Rash. And then we have another distinguished panel on Tuesday night talking about the ethics of geoengineering, solar radiation management. If you're around, the panel, the flyers are up here.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a couple of questions and then I'm going to open it up to everyone else. David Keith, I follow geoengineering on Twitter, and most of the news is about chemtrails. So how about those chemtrails?
We've got a squad of security agents outside. So how can you don't know the term chemtrails? Don't know. Okay. So chemtrails is a conspiracy theory, and the conspiracy theory postulates that the U.S. government is deliberately spraying toxins from aircraft in very large quantities. And the reasons for spraying those toxins seem to vary with different variants of the conspiracy theory, but mass culling of the population seems to be one, or mind control another. Those are the most common ones. And this theory is seems to go back about 15 or 20 years, and it links to a few others. So there's concern that something called the HART site, a site that beams microwaves into the aurora in Alaska, is somehow controlling the weather or doing something evil or causing cancer or whatnot. And just to be absolutely clear, for those of you who might be tempted by this conspiracy theory, I'll give you my reason why I don't believe it. It's not because I believe government doesn't screw up and do evil things. I know it does. But I can't think of any case in history, and I really can't imagine a possibility where government would, at a massive scale, the scale that they're talking about, deliberately exterminate its own citizens in that way, and it be secret. Because for this to work, of course, there have to be hundreds of engineering documents. People have had to build all this equipment on airplanes that loads this tons of material. And it's just, in a democracy, exceedingly hard to keep that secret. So government can keep secret a little operation to do some evil thing. We all know they do that. But you can't really keep secret mass things like that. There just is really no such examples, especially when there's no obvious reason. So we may have different views about the war in Afghanistan, and probably a lot of us agree about it. But you know, military people do stuff because they feel there's at least some justification. Yeah, it's hard to think that anybody would see much justification for just spraying poisons from airplanes over California. So that's a conspiracy theory. And it's become conflated with geoengineering. And it is pretty dramatic. So to give you a sense of how real this is, I've had to call the police because a local man who works at a car detailing organization concluded that I was a mass murderer and it might be better to read. I have voicemails that say I'm, I think, 10 million times more evil than Hitler and Stalin. I have, at the AAAS meeting in San Diego about half a year ago, there were about 30 protesters, and I and Alan Robach both took time to talk to the protesters, and it was actually a very interesting experience. I've had quite a lot of dialogue with people now, because I tend to always answer the emails. And the way I see it, there seems to be two groups of people in the chemtrails conspiracy. The main group, I think, is an extreme right group that sees climate change as a bunch of lies, and the purpose of the lies is to give government an excuse to regulate us, our lives more. But then there's also a more environmental end that sees, that I think does see sort of what I would more expect, an environmental end that sees anybody talking about geoengineering as evil because they're talking about manipulating the planet, and then kind of conflates that with the chemtrails. trails conspiracy, but we're just actually about to do a mass poll in the U.S. I'm paying a polling firm to do this, and it'll all be public and so on. And we're going to try and figure out how common this belief is, but my guess is it's not like 1 in 1,000. I think it's quite a few percent of the mass population. It's quite an interesting thing, and how it plays out about the politics of this will be interesting. I guess one more thing to say is, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have guessed that we would find that many people in the mainstream environmental movements were opposed to research or work on this, and in general, that's been the opposite of the case.
Thank you. Dane, who gets to decide, and what kind of factors go into, like, who's the winners and who's the losers on geoengineering? Can you talk a little bit about that?
On Thursday, I could do a better job. But I think it's just what people are asking those exact questions. We don't know, right? We don't know how that would work. In fact, we're having a really hard time doing this with climate change, right? And so I think, I don't know if the problem would be as difficult with geoengineering because it's more defined. But it would, you know, suffer from the same sort of, you know, problems. And then there are problems. That, you know, the knowledge gap. Right, is one thing that people have pointed out in terms of governance. You know, who would do this? Well, there's only a few countries in the world that have the scientists, the literature, you know, the sort of educational, you know, apparatus to sort of, you know, sort of understand and implement this. And so there would be a gap, you know, globally, because this does affect the globe, between different countries, right? And there's just it's a hornet's nest, actually, of sort of problems when you talk about governance. Some of the things that have been mentioned, if you've read this stuff, you know, in comments on this, is differential effects. You know, some people might want a warmer climate. Some people might want a cooler climate, depending on where they live. So I don't think, you know, it's so early, but I just think what people are doing now is just identifying all those sorts of problems with governance one would encounter. And I think, as you know, with governance, one of the biggest problems, you know, internationally is undue influence, right? There are people with time, with money, to hire lobbyists and to hire firms that can court of manipulate the system, you know, to be in their favor. This, you know, this is no news. And so that would be a problem. And with this sort of thing, one would want to be really careful to avoid the prejudice that would involve in the government structure. So that would be a real problem. How could we overcome that sort of undue influence given the inequity or the unlevel playing field that you have starting in terms of education, intellectual knowledge, in terms of funding, you know, money and all sorts of things. So, you know, there, like I said, there are no answers except people are identifying problems at this stage.
Eli, you're a policy person. What do you think are the biggest challenges for policymakers in the coming years about geoengineering?
Well, I think it's very difficult to say because we've had so little discussion in Washington about the topic. David, behind closed doors, you know, I'm sure has met with a fair number of folks in the various agencies that might be interested in this, and I've certainly talked to folks in the environmental community who, as David points out, haven't yet really come out in opposition to research on the topic, but I think it's unclear, since we don't really have a bead yet on how the public perceives it, it's difficult to know how politicians might react. This idea really hasn't made it to prime time, despite my book and another book, and I think increasingly public interest. I mean, to start with, I think one of the challenges is, since I happen to believe that there ought to be research on different types of these geoengineering techniques, I think one challenge is how do you encourage that research without getting the research banned? Because I think there are going to be folks, already there are folks who are calling, and even just next week there's a meeting in Japan, the Convention on Biological Diversity will be meeting, and there's already proposed language that convention passes a ban on activities related to geoengineering. It's unclear what that would mean, but my point is, if you were to propose in Washington a centralized research program or DOE to do it, it's unclear how the debate on that might go, and so I'd say the central challenge is encouraging the research without getting it banned, I guess.
I think I have the opposite concern. I think things are moving too fast. I think this really isn't the world that I'm seeing. So I want people who's helped to open up the door. I wrote about this 20 years ago and get people to think about it. And a lot of my colleagues are sort of impatient and feel like, why don't we have a research program now? I'm the opposite. I see a stampede towards the door. I'm working on panels on CEGRIT. It's a well-funded public thing by the Bipartisan Policy Council. That is working with a bunch of folks in D.C. There's a House Science Committee that's worked the issue, and GAO, and we've also worked with OTA. And we've, as a formal way, it's not like I'm formally lobbying, we are doing this. And on that panel, the chief scientists of two of the biggest environmental organizations, I have not talked to a single person in any of those meetings who is not in favor of research, not one. So I am not remotely worried we won't have a research program. We already have research programs in the UK, in Germany, in the EU. I am worried we will rush to do this. Mm-hmm. I am worried that there will be too much research too fast and we will be regulated. I think that there's somehow this idea I keep hearing talks, sorry to pick on you, where people stand up and say, there's going to be such a taboo, and then we have a show of hands and nobody puts up their hands in funding research. I've done that several times. So I think this is basically a myth. I'm serious. I've had a lot of conversation in D.C. with a lot of people. I don't recall anybody. There are people who have concerns, very legitimate concerns about governance that I share. But I haven't heard anybody say that there should not be a research program. So I really have the opposite worry. I worry about things moving too fast. And just like we haven't yet figured out, we all know, technology moves faster than our ethical capacity to absorb that technology. And that's my fear with this one.
Thank you. I'm going to open the floor to questions now. I'm going to ask people who are SEJ members and have blue badges and working journalists. You get first dibs. Thanks.
Valerie? Just one quick comment.
Could you please identify?
Valerie that? Brown, freelance. Just a really quick thing, and then I have a question. But the quick thing is that I wrote an article about environmental health effects of war during the Kosovo War, and the Serbs were blaming the HAARP program and the United States for just making really bad weather over Serbia at the time. So, and that was, I can't remember when that was, the war, but it's been around for a long time, and it's a very good scapegoat for a lot of people. My second question is, to me, I worry about sort of techno cowboys deciding that a high-tech sort of large-scale fix is going to be what we need to do, and I guess I wonder what would happen if somebody that had a lot of money, like Bill Gates, or I don't know, it could be anybody with a lot of money, the Koch brothers or somebody, decided to just do a geoengineering action on their own, because people are doing all kinds of high technology actions now without a whole lot of public input. And would there be an international governance control on that kind of behavior at the moment? So I don't know who could answer that question.
I'm willing to have a whack at it. I mean, so one important fact to get out there that I think may be slightly different from what Dave was saying is this is horrifically cheap to do. It now is looking like you might be able to alter the global climate substantially for a couple billion a year. That means, and knowledge, this knowledge is all public domain, essentially. So this diffuses very, very fast. So this is not limited to a few big countries. Any country that wants to pay Lockheed Martin or any aircraft or Boeing or Airbus to do this can do it. And in particular, you could imagine scenarios where, for example, the small island nations got tired of, I mean, they're the ones who are most strident in negotiations, and they, quite rightly, are very upset, as I am, they've had no action to cut emissions, and they could use this as a threat. So they could basically say to the world, you guys get serious. We want to see serious action on restraining emissions by 2020, or we're going to start doing that. And I think it's just the small island nations, it doesn't really work because they don't have military power, but it does work if it's some other poor nations that do have military power. So I am the idea, so first of all, the Bill Gates stuff, we've now been completely open about it, and it was interesting. It took us a while to do that for reasons that I don't think are pernicious, but maybe others did. But we now have a website that's exactly what we do, and it's all philanthropic, and Bill Gates gets no benefit back, and blah, 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 et cetera, really funded. But I don't think there's any chance that a rich person in a democracy like the U.S. or Europe could just go do this. There's lots of restraints, lots and lots of restraints. So we have could have a better rule of law, but we have one. I think it's much more likely that large countries in the poor world would do it. I mean, the fact is the biggest direct threat to crops is stress. And countries like India and some countries in Africa and China are the ones most likely to actually need to do it. And if it's India or China, they're both nuclear armed countries. And we don't have some massive global governance. We have what we have.
There's a question over here.
Yeah, Mark Gunther from greenbiz.com and Fortune Magazine. I'm wondering what research would look like. Is it someone sitting at a computer, or to research this, do you actually have to start trying it on a small scale, and how then would you measure whether it's working or not?
I can just tell you what, since it, for my book, I tried to look, you know, figure out who was doing what. At this point, you know, the number of papers is growing quickly, scientists doing it. Nearly all of them are either using computers to do modeling. There are a few papers that involve physical calculations. There are ethical papers with ethicists or policy people. In my book, I begin with a kind of weird outdoor test of spraying smoke and that some Russian scientists were up to a couple of years ago. But if there are any medium or large scale tests out there in terms of the cooling, we haven't heard about it. There's a group of American and British atmospheric scientists who are interested in a technique that would brighten clouds by adding particles to these low-lying clouds. And there's talk of an experiment, but they haven't announced one. And there's experience that the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy have funded iron fertilization experiments, which involve dumping iron solution in the ocean to encourage the growth of algae. And those were done essentially for basic science, but also had a potential application for carbon sequestration on a mass scale. So that's sort of what's out there.
I think there are three categories. The first category is all the stuff that's sort of behind closed doors. It's having adults, basically computer models and tests and little bits of hardware. And that is basically what the European and, because there are now public research programs, so the British and German programs are basically funding that as the EU, separate EU program. And I'm almost certain that's what the EU programs are funding. The next step is to fund what people in the atmospheric science call process studies. So these are studies that test some key link at a scale that tests the underlying atmospheric process but doesn't have to be big enough to actually have a measurable climate impact. So for example, this one that Eli just mentioned, this idea is you spray little sea salt particles from ships in certain parts of the marine environment, and those sea salt particles make clouds a little bit whiter. And there's a question about the efficiency with which the particles make it from where you spray them to the clouds. You can do a bunch of experiments that quantify that really well while having less climate impact than a single freighter sailing across the ocean. And I didn't make that number up. And so those are process studies. And that is not to say that there shouldn't be scrutiny of those. So the point is intent matters. And even things that don't damage the climate should have governance and scrutiny. In the same sense as getting all the bits ready to build a nuclear weapon doesn't hurt anybody, but intent and capability matter. So I do think those should have scrutiny, but be clear, there's a great deal of stuff you could do that involves outdoor experiments at a scale much too small to have any climate impact. The next step, I think, is an experiment. The next step is subscale deployment, where you actually begin to do this at a scale big enough to have a just barely measurable climate impact, and hopefully the point, obviously, would be to have some substantial environmental benefit, but obviously there would be risk. And that, I think, is
And far back.
Thanks very much, regarding the panel. My name is Bruce Glass, environmental journalist. I've written some about natural carbon sequestration, direct carbon sequestration. Why there's not a better sort of synergy between bioengineering as this premature and natural sequestration attempts. So I'll just give a few sources. You know, Target CO2, Hansen's paper, it ends with this schema of how to bring inert carbon back, levels back down. I read a little bit on World Watch, an article on that, and there's the scientist Matan Lal of the Carbon Sequestration Center in Ohio State. So I was wondering, and there's also a lot of activity in biochar, which is not more of a carbon recalcitrant than carbon sequestration. I was wondering why there's not more alliance, step by step synergies.
So there are lots of opportunities basically to increase the carbon stock in the biosphere. So, for example, in New England, I mean, as some of you may know, North America is actually close to carbon neutral. A stunning and true fact. And the reason is because we cut down so much forest 100 years ago. Remember, we only switched to be dominant fossil fuel about 120 years ago. And there's been a huge regrowth. So there's a carbon sink, a large carbon sink in America, which doesn't count in the IPCC, but it's a real sink. It doesn't count because it basically represents regrowth. So those of you who lived in New England, you walk around all those forests and you see stone walls. That was because we basically cut it all down. And then that regrowth is sucking carbon that we emitted 100 years ago back out of the air. So there are lots of ways in which we can manipulate that process to, in principle, put more carbon stock on land. There are real limits. Let's just get some numbers on the table. We're talking about putting more carbon into the biosphere for fossil fuels, even under moderate scenarios, than all the carbon stocks in the biosphere. So, and there are real limits to how much you can increase things without having environmental consequences you might not want to have. And there are also a kind of tinderbox risk that as it warms up, a lot of that carbon will get mobilized. And so it's not clear to me how safe the strategy is at large scale. Now, there are lots of niches where this can be very effective. So, for example, I and the student J.D. Rose have spent a lot of time looking at biomass co-firing in coal-fired power plants. And it turns out that, for various interesting political reasons, is not popular with the environmental community, this one, because they feel like it gives coal plants somehow a chance. But it's one of the very cheapest, most effective things, and very limited things you could do. It's a niche. Basically, in places where you have waste wood, and you have coal plants. You can feed the waste wood in the coal plants, and it only gets you about a 10% emissions cut, but it's very cheap and really effective, but it's limited. Once you start going beyond waste wood to growing purpose-grown biomass, then the environmental impacts are much more mixed. Biochar is a big mess. I'm happy to talk with you about it more. There's clearly something real there, but there's a lot of hype, and we just don't know enough to separate the hype from reality now.
Jim, you had a question.
I wonder.
Identify yourself.
Oh yeah, Jim Robbins. I'm right with the New York Times from Helena. And I wondered, I've gotten calls from Northern California a couple after I wrote a story about forests that were dying. And I wondered if, leaving aside the slaughter of humanity and reduction of the Earth's population and conspiracy theories, is it possible that there is some large scale testing going on secretly somewhere because of the difficulty of getting something like this passed or the environmental studies that might be required, and given the urgency of climate change, is it possible at all?
It's possible, but it's very unlikely, I think. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I've spent a lot of time worrying about nuclear weapons, and I have physicists, I have lots of friends who work behind in Los Alamos, as Los Alamos that worked at 9/11. And I think that one thing you learn if you follow military affairs is that there are not very many secrets, and that anything at substantial scale is very hard to do. And we can keep tactical battlefield stuff secret for a little while, but then it leaks out. It's just remarkable how few secrets there are that are real. And I think, I know some of the people who might be doing that. And, I mean, it's not impossible. Nothing's impossible, but it seems to be really unlikely. I just don't understand the motives and understand how that would actually be happening. This Russian test, I think, was a deliberate provocation. I don't think it was scientifically crap. But I think it was because the people involved wanted to just put people's buttons. think it's going to happen, it'll be more likely happening in China. I think it's very unlikely it's happening here because just, you know, why you complain about the U.S., but the things in the Sunshine Laws really have changed things here. I see that going back to Canada, where we actually have much less freedom in that way than the U.S. does, and it's hard to imagine.
I hear drips and pieces. Oh, I'm Ilsa Sentinel. I'm an environment writer based in Los Angeles. I've heard drips and pieces about all of these technologies, but it's are there some that, so you're saying that many of them were very feasible, but can you prioritize them in terms of some that seem to raise the most ecological or environmental atmospheric concerns versus those that seem to raise fewer concerns?
I mean, a couple of the reports, the big reports I've done, have sort of pictures where you graph how effective at taking carbon or cooling the planet in terms of carbon removed versus the risks, so you can see that. In general, like David says, the two categories where you have cooling methods versus carbon sucking methods generally have, because the carbon sucking methods generally are dealing with the crux of the problem, which is too much greenhouse gas, you generally have sort of less attendant effects on a global scale, but you might have local problems. The cooling methods may more quickly respond to the effects we're seeing, which is a warmer planet, but they might have unintended climate effects. But I'm sure either of these guys can add a tail to that.
Everything you said is exactly right. Removing carbon from the atmosphere is just plain good, but the way you do it may have a local environmental harm, which could be disastrous in that way. Good. The cooling things that are almost certainly the most credible are putting reflective aerosols in the stratosphere. That's the one that we really know how to do, and it seems at first cut to have the best possibility of having a relatively low environmental risk and to have a big environmental benefit in terms of pushing the climate, both the temperature. People often think it's not just temperature, not hydrology, but in fact, that doing this pushes the precipitation and rainfall patterns back towards what they were before we messed with the climate.
Just real briefly, I think the reason we focused in our grant on solar radiation management is these global scale technologies raise more ethical questions. And the carbon sequestration or painting roofs white, for example, which is the solar radiation management, those kind of technologies don't raise the same kind of questions.
Thanks, Cheryl. Jeff Neames, Fairfax Media in New Zealand. David, just a question for you on the Chinese. I believe they've been looking at this issue of cloud seeding and perhaps even been experimenting with it to increase rainfall in some of the drier parts of their country. Does that fall under this geoengineering sort of umbrella, and what, whether you had any views on whether it was feasible and perhaps less damaging to the environment?
Generally think about it as different. And I think there's a surprising fact that I'm not going to try to explain now, but I think there's actually really simple physics explanations for, that it's actually easier to manipulate the climate in some ways than the weather. And so cloud seeding, certainly Chinese are doing it, and it's being done still commercially in the U.S. And it's been controversial. There's been liability since it started. It doesn't work very well. It's not clear that it doesn't work at all. There was a boom in cloud seeding started in 1949 in the U.S., and a few years later we had the Advisory Commission on Climate and Weather Control, which in some ways was the beginning of a formal commission in Washington, D.C., Senate and House committees that began to be worrying about climate and weather stuff. And if you look at the membership of those committees, those basically, there's a famous line from there to the IPCC that basically was the beginning of formal concerns about climate and weather. And those concerns came out of liability, because there's most cloud seeding has a very strong Rob, Peter, to pay Paul element, so that if it works, I mean, there's only a limited amount of moisture in the air. If I'm a farmer, Eli's a farmer, and I do successfully, mostly because it works, make the rain fall on me, it's likely less of it's falling on Eli.
And the Chinese scientists I've talked to about this complain that everyone in the scientific community in China knows that it's not credible or it's not understandable, doesn't really work, but there's a political push for local officials to tell farmers we're doing something.
So it looks good politically to try and do something, but it's in a big...
I'm not an expert. My sense is it's pretty ineffective, but it may be ineffective sometimes. It may be limited effectiveness sometimes in some places. But again, it is sort of mostly Peter to pay Paul aspect, where you can sometimes produce rain in some places.
Billions are spent on weather modification around the world.
Yeah.
And we don't know that it works.
Peter. Apparently I'm a freelance writer based in Victoria, British Columbia. Have we really been conducting an experiment in geoengineering for the last 30, 40 years with shifting levels of sulfate aerosols and black carbon, and trying to very much after the fact that starting to figure out what impacts each one has in terms of the local cooling or warming, and given what seems to be an immense potential to drive very short-term meaningful reductions in warming by controlling black carbon, why aren't we seeing that more quickly? And is it because it's maybe associated with geoengineering?
I want to get Dave to respond first, but just for the people who don't know in the audience, black carbon is basically soot, and it turns out that it causes a warming. It's not a greenhouse gas, but it causes a warming because when it's in the sky, it warms the atmosphere when it's hit by sun, and when it lands on snow, it makes the snow more absorbing rather than reflective. But go ahead.
First of all, just to quibble, I think intent matters. Intent matters in our laws. Intent matters in the long tradition that many religions and philosophies have. So I think there's a difference between engineering and making a mess. And I don't. I mean, a lot of people want to say, "Well, we're already geoengineering because we're putting carbon in the air." And the reason we're putting carbon in the air is not to change the climate. We're putting carbon in the air to provide energy services that people want. I don't know if you would talk about what you think about industrial capitalism, but certainly that wasn't the intent. And I think that matters. It's a side benefit. If we really want to put a lot of carbon in the air, we can do it much faster. Indeed, just to give you a sense of history, so people began to think about this. You could argue even in the 18th. So when Arrhenius first got the basic science of climate change right and correctly calculated that if we keep putting fossil fuels in the atmosphere, we warm the place up, Ekholm, a contemporary of Arrhenius's, writing in the 1890s, suggested that maybe we should just burn coal mines at the surface in order to accelerate this, what Arrhenius saw as a virtuous cycle where increasing populations that needed more food would burn coal and that would warm up the planet and move the limits of agriculture northwards, the guys writing in Sweden. So these are old topics. Come back again. But the answer to your question is there's a great deal scientifically to learn about the ways in which this might work from the emission of sulfur in the troposphere. I think the way it bites politically is the following sort of calculation. So there's a great deal of sulfur in marine shipping, and that's one of these wonderful side effects of regulations. We told refiners, don't put that sulfur in the stuff you're selling to cars. The refiners said, yes, sir. And they like to conserve mass, so they put all the sulfur in the stuff they were selling to marine diesels because that wasn't ready yet. And so that turns out that sometimes marine diesel is like 3% sulfur. It's a gigantic environmental problem that people didn't pay attention to until about 10 years ago. Now the International Maritime Agency is getting ready to regulate that marine sulfur, which is great. And that will save, I'm not making this number up, kind of 10,000s or many tens of thousands of lives from predicted air pollution. But it will also, it's a single committee decision, it'll be a committee decision that warms the planet up more than any other this decade, because they're going to remove the sulfur, which is now a cooling effect. So that sulfur is cooling the planet by making marine clouds more reflective. And taking it out will reveal some of the hidden warming that is there because of the CO2 that we're now masking. And so you could make an argument, a pure sort of salesmanship argument for geoengineering, this would be my salesmanship. And maybe it is. You could say, well, maybe what we should do is take the sulfur out of the marine environment where it is causing lots of environmental, where it's quite ineffective sulfur in cooling the planet and it causes a lot of health problems, and put a much tinier amount, I think it turns out to be like 1,000 times less sulfur in the stratosphere where it will do cooling without causing the health impacts. And you could say we should just have exactly the same amount of cooling, so we won't cool the planet any more than the current marine sulfur. We'll just stop doing it by dumping the sulfur into the marine boundary.
I just want to add very quickly, I think it was 1990 or so, Paul Crutzen, the Nobel Prize winning atmospheric chemist that Dave mentioned, wrote a paper where he described the current era of time we're in, of geologic time, as the Anthropocene. He said that a good number of natural systems around the Earth, not just the atmosphere, but water and soils and the Arctic and deserts, are affected more by human action than by natural processes. And so I take it in my book just to kind of step further, and I say that's a kind of inadvertent effect of the global environment. And I think whether or not we use geoengineering as a tool in the next decades, I think just with the discussion of this idea, we've sort of entered a new phase where not only are we doing global change inadvertently, we're considering and may actually try a kind of inadvertent global change, what I call the era of geoengineering.
Don Corrigan, Times Newspapers in St. Louis. This question is only half facetious, but if you really get concerned about the kind of technology that's being developed, who's going to put the skids on it? University ethicists? Or do you plant the conspiracy theories and Tea Party groups and scream about how this engineering is out of control and it's a government conspiracy? And
well, I mean, there's a lot of, things, analogies you could look at in terms of, emerging technologies. You know, they raise ethical issues. And, there may be some parallels in the biotechnology. When Monsanto and other companies, they invested whole hoggins, right? They staked, as one of the CEOs staked their professional life on this. And there was a huge backlash. I think it remains to be seen. Like, this hasn't gone prime time, as you said. And a lot of that had to do with, the biotech, had to do with European Greenpeace, I believe. And they had an effective campaign, right? And I the biotech revolution has not, even though you have these widespread crops, they're just a few crops. I mean, the skids were put on, if you would. And so I think there are going to be alarms. I don't think that, people may be cautiously raising their hand for research because they're worried we're not acting prudently, And I think that's often the reason given is the slow action or inaction on addressing the problem. But I do think that there are, ethicists are jumping on this. There's a place in Oxford where they're thinking about things. We're thinking about them in Montana. I don't know if academic ethicists have that much power, but other people do raise these ethical issues as well, and it remains to be seen. I think there would be. My suspicion, after studying the emerging technology of biotechnology, there was a strong ethical reaction, and it's still there. So I think the skids, people would go whoa. I think as soon as this hits prime time.
One of the hopes of many of us is that by talking about this, really distasteful and troublesome concept, that people will take the idea that we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions more seriously than they have. I don't know if that's going to be the effect.
Dan Fagan, I'm a professor of journalism at NYU, and I'm a writer also. This is a dangerous question because I came in late, so forgive me if it's repetitious. But what is likely to be the precipitating event that takes it to prime time that triggers this national conversation or international conversation? What's in the short and medium term horizon that's actually going to happen?
I'll be first, then. In thinking, in my class, we sort of play these scenarios. And oftentimes, I think people's moral compass starts pointing north when they feel the effects. In other words, it is a really difficult climate change. It's a really difficult problem because the effects seem distant from you. It's not happening in your neighborhood. It's, happening over there, or it's happening down the road. And people, studies have been done that show people think it's an important issue, but they list it as a very low priority. And I think that is because they don't feel the immediate impacts. They see it as a moral problem. They see it as an issue of justice. But they don't feel the impacts. And I think once people start to feel impacts, then they start, it becomes more acute. It becomes more imminent. And I think, again, I think this is human nature. I'm not making a judgment about, the moral moral capacity of people, but most people start to really take, you know, moral issues seriously when they feel the effects. So I could see this hitting prime time when we start hitting, feeling the effects, and because David has pointed out the inertia of, you know, greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, CO2, then you're going to have to do something a little more drastic.
Do you see that as a near term? No, I don't. So really, we're not going to have this sort of big geoengineering yes or no conversation.
Well, yeah, I don't know about my ability to predict things, but you know, when I just, you know, human nature. If you were looking at it, when you start feeling the facts, you start taking action, and then by then it might need something other than a strong mitigation.
I would distinguish the elite conversation sort of about research from the big implementation conversation. So I think Paul Crutzen's article basically was the beginning of the snowball for the elite conversation. And at the pace it's happening is truly stunning. I mean, just speaking personally, I've been in front of the UK Parliament and the US House, and I mean, things are happening all out of this year. I mean, the pace is very fast. It was just a big meeting of the New America Foundation. We had, there was a big DC event a few weeks ago, and keep getting calls of new ones. So I think that's basically happening in the elite world. The fact is, in the mass world, nobody cares that much about climate change. Why that is true is one of the real mysteries here, one of the very deeply disturbing things. And if you don't care that much about climate change, obviously you don't care that much about this either. So I think in terms of the conversation that deals with the basic getting a research program and getting some initial governance in place for geoengineering, that's basically happening. And I think it'll happen next year. And it'll, you know, you'll see stories in the New York Times, but it's not going to be the first thing on the evening news. At some point, we're going to have to pay attention to climate change. But when that is and what the precipitating event is, I'm guessing.
Hi, Clint Wilder from Clean Edge. David, you mentioned something about this could be done for $2 billion a year. What were you specifically referring to?
Well, this, so distinguish these two totally different things. So this idea of taking carbon out of the air is inherently expensive. And the fact that it's expensive is in a way a good thing. It means there's no danger of sort of Dr. Evil sucking all the CO2 out of the air because it's just too expensive to do that. Not that there aren't Dr. Evils around. But for putting reflective materials in the stratosphere, I mean, even with the way we know how to do it right now, the costs look like they'd be just several billion a year. And you probably think of cleverer ways to do it. So it's a gigantic leverage. I mean, to give that some perspective, I know billion sounds like a lot, but remember, we've got a $60 trillion global economy, and it's a few percent a year to cut emissions. So that means the cost of what we need to be doing to cut emissions, like CO2, is like a trillion kind of numbers a year. So a billion is a very small number. In this
David,
I'm
sorry, George Shea, I'm a freelance writer in Los Angeles. As far as putting reflective aerosols, would it be possible to test that now on a very small scale with a lot of very careful scrutiny? I mean, are we risking a catastrophe if we start doing that?
Well, I think we're not risking a catastrophe because Pinatubo put 10 megatons of sulfur in the stratosphere and we didn't have a catastrophe. The world got cooler and there were some hydrological changes and plants grew a little quicker and there was no catastrophe. Yeah. And so it's hard to imagine that putting one megaton in the air yet would cause a catastrophe, and putting 10 didn't. But on the other hand, I don't think, so as I said, there's these process tests. So for example, just replicating Pinatubo turns out to work very well. There's some clever scheme. I published a paper, other people have. And if you want to test all the clever schemes, you could do it with kilograms. It wouldn't change the climate, it'd be one of these process tests. But to actually start doing it, you really are talking about doing it at a level where you begin to measure. Whether that's the right thing or not, I don't know. It depends on which side of the, my opinion, depends on which side of the bed I get up in the morning. But you can make a coherent argument that within a decade or so, it makes sense to begin to gradually ramp it up very gently, and you begin to get some benefit in reducing the rate of warming in the Arctic while you watch for any unexpected side effects.
Yeah, Robert
Brule,
Brown University. I have a question about geoengineering. Always one of the big critiques of it is that says nothing about ocean acidification. Is there any effective geoengineering strategies to deal with ocean acidification? I've just thrown a line on the ocean, so there's a lot of line. We need to bring it together.
Well, I mean,
thing that takes carbon out of the air is dealing with eutrophication. So if you count these other, those carbon removal things as geoengineering, then yes. The solar radiation stuff doesn't do anything about eutrophication. But... Not the quick and easy. There's no quick and easy way to deal with ocean acidification at global scale. And I believe there probably never will be one because it implicitly involves moving a great deal of bases around to counteract the acid.
Cheryl touched on it, but I don't know if it was explicit for people. David is a company that is building machines that would suck carbon dioxide out of the sky, basically.
Well, yeah, the company's called Carbon Engineering. We're trying to develop the hardware that... if it all worked out, and if there was a pilot plant, and if there was a price on carbon, and some regulation could enable you to take CO2 out of the air.
So,
was it
Mark?
David,
identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Mark Flutstein with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. In that context, you're funded by Bill Gates.
Yeah. Well, so there's two different things. I'm funded by a whole bunch of things, so I'm off the topic. So, yeah. Carbon issue.
Yeah. On the machinery stuff.
So that's this private startup company. It's called Carbon Engineering. Bill was one of the angel investors, but that's less than half of the funding. And this is true of lots of private angel things. We don't reveal to the investors. I've never done this before. I'm normally an academic. Everything else that I do is either government funded or there is some funding from Bill Gates in a totally philanthropic way, legally philanthropic with checks and balances. But that company, and again, as you start to build a company, I'm not the uniquely in control of the company. There's a board and all that stuff. So
okay, so my question actually has to do with something that I know that Bill Gates does often, which is attempt to go figure out if there's new technology out there and grab the patents. And so I guess that's what I'm asking is whether or not you have any concerns that anything you develop that you may lose control of the patents and it might just be taken off the market while waiting for a need to occur that makes it
So let's distinguish the two sorts of, I mean, I do a lot of, basically a lot of stuff that's not either geoengineering, I'm working on how big an impact the oil and gas industry has on land, so, and that actually is also funded through the Bill Gates stuff, so I'm not particularly concerned. I am concerned about too much private action in solar radiation management, and I think it's not healthy to have too much, even though some of the private money is flowing through us. I think it's very important to the public because this giant leverage over the planet is a dangerous thing, and I think that should be dogmatically in public hands. I personally have said publicly that I will not file any patents on those technologies, and I haven't. And indeed, I think it's fair to say I've had the only two recent sort of papers that have been fundamental innovations in how you do the solar stuff, and neither of them we patented before publishing. And I believe it's wrong to do that. On the air capture stuff for pulling CO2 out of the air, that's operating. I don't see there being such a big moral conflict there, personally, because I think it's a technology that gets regulated by the normal ways that regulation happens, in the sense it would be like lots of other technologies that would have local siting regulations and all that. So that company works as a normal company. Yes, it's filing patents and Bill's an investor, but that doesn't mean he controls the company, does it?
Let me just highlight something that David had pointed to. I listed, the ethical issues that one would need to work out in talking about this, and I think David just did a nice job pointing, private-public research, private-public patent, what kind of regime are we going to have? Is it going to be a public? Is it going to be private? Is it going to be... And I think that's a very important ethical issue, and I think David did a nice job articulating it, so just wanted to highlight that.
We're done in 5 minutes. I just say what my two big fears are here, because some of them haven't quite come up. One big fear is a sort of a runaway. I hinted at that, but I think most of the scientists, I think I would agree, now working on the solar radiation stuff are basically environmentalists motivated to reduce the environmental problem. And we may be misguided, but that's the motive of lots of us. But once you develop a new technology, you lose control. And it is very unclear what plays out in the long run. I think Eli and both of you have hinted at this. So one of my big fears is that even if we start doing this with the intention that what we want to do is to reduce some of the risks from CO2 in the air while we cut emissions, once you start, there's no stopping. And you could imagine very, very different outcomes. So
Once you decide your wholesale business is deliberately engineering the planet, then you've got to deal with who you're engineering it for. And if the answer is just for people and not for nature, then you may decide there are other climates you'd rather have than the one we have now. If you hired me to maximize global crop productivity, it's pretty clear that what I would do is increase CO2 while I did some geoengineering. I would not go back to pre-industrial climate. I'm not saying that's what we should do, but when you let, in fact, quite the opposite, that I rebel at building against that, but if you, once you let one of these technologies out, it's hard to control what happens. And that's one of my big fears. But the other fear is that sort of political correctness and fear of talking about this. My other fear is that if we get to 2050 and we find the Arctic's really been melting away, and then we do a bunch of research that shows actually these technologies could have done some use in preventing the warming, even if they weren't perfect, and that we didn't use them because of some kind of political correctness fear, then that's another kind of error. So I see potential errors, both of omission and commission here.
Are there any other questions from SEJ members or from working journalists here? I'm sorry, Ilse, you're
welcome. I don't know if we have time. You mentioned that biochar was a big mess. Give us the nutshell on why it's a big mess. I actually was approached by a local researcher about his biochar project.
So one thing I'm going to do is I send you Steve Haberg, the chief scientist of environmental defense, who's very thoughtful on this. I mean, took a beer with him on Thursday on this topic. What to say? I think biochar advocates claim two advantages. One advantage is that the biochar actually increases crop productivity. And to the extent that that's really true, there's no question that's a good thing. And my reading, I'm not an expert, is there's just not that much data on where that is or isn't true. In particular, in mid-latitude farming practices, there's very, very little data. So there's some anecdotes to suggest it might be good, but it's pretty much problematic. And that's something we can just go measure, but it hasn't been done. The other argument is that this works as carbon burial. And I have a kind of basic problem with that, which is that right now we're mining a bunch of coal and burning it. And taking biomass and putting it underground is a negative coal mine. And it's not obvious to me why I want to engineer a lot of negative coal mines while I still have positive coal mines. I just don't get it. And I mean, there are some answers to that in some niches, but in general, if I've gone the trouble to make biochar and I live in a world where I still have coal plants, the best thing to do is to shove that biochar in a coal plant and offset the coal. So that can be not true in cases of transportation. But again, that's forgetting about this benefit. If it really makes soils more productive, that's a benefit.
Robert Fraser, I'm a freelancer. I live in Peru, and I have an ethics question for Dane Scott. You said that people tend to, what's likely to be the moment that pushes things into action is likely to be the moment at which people feel affected by climate change. The people who are feeling most affected by climate change now just don't happen to live in the United States. They live in the Andes, they live in Himalayas, they live in Africa. What needs to be done to get these people into the picture? I find it very difficult to write about things like this in a way that makes people in the United States realize that there's a connection.
Yeah, I've also talked about that in my class. I gave a seminar this summer to a group of students from Vietnam. And it was a very different experience. You know, they were citing examples, of the effects on their rivers and where they were living. And so it was happening, right, for them. And it's a very different thing when I teach students, from Montana. They don't have the same sort of reaction. And one of the things I was talking about, I'm not sure this is exactly getting at your question, but I was talking about the knowledge gap. And I wasn't really talking about the technological ability. But I was talking about the knowledge gap in stakeholders as far as stakeholder participation in geoengineering, for example. And I think, the people where this could be, they wouldn't know about this. And one of the things we're doing in our research is we're trying to, underrepresented populations, we have a social scientist working with us on these ethical issues, that are going to people that would be left out of the conversation. And they are going to talk to them about geoengineering and see what they have to say. And so I don't have any grand answers for you. I just say that you've exactly identified a problem, right, about this participation and the dialogue about what we're going to do about it and sort of this imbalance that we have. Go ahead.
I'll just
I mean, his students from Vietnam are one thing. They're here at a university. They know what's going on. But my colleagues at the Red Cross, for example, when they have talked to people, the people don't, they have no idea in a lot of developing countries where the Red Cross works in disasters, have no idea that the planet is warming. They have no idea what carbon dioxide is. And so to add on, I mean, if you think Americans don't care about climate change, I mean, they just don't even know the basic vocabulary. And so to then expect in a decade or two to have a kind of informed global conversation about changing the planet, I mean, to me, it's really a lot to ask.
You know, just to highlight that, that's one of the real ethical issues, is how do you have real procedural justice or real participation in a conversation about this with these kind of barriers that you mentioned. There's just inequities in terms of knowledge, location, you know, money, you know, all of these sorts of inequities are sort of playing into a field that's not even at all. And then how do you try to come out with something that's sort of fair and just in terms of making good decisions about it?
Well, we've reached the magic hour of noon, and I've been told I have to cut this off now. But would you join me in thanking our speakers? Yeah.